If you enjoy The Spectator's podcast, why not subscribe to the magazine as well? You can get 12 weeks of The Spectator for just £12, plus a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher if you go to spectator.co.uk/voucher. This is a podcast-only deal, and we hope you take us up on it.
Hello and welcome to the Edition podcast from The Spectator, where each week we shed a little light on the thought process behind putting the world's oldest weekly magazine to bed. I'm William Moore, The Spectator's features editor.
And I'm Laura Prendergast, The Spectator's executive editor.
This week we go inside the campus Palestine protests and discuss the legacy of Beryl Cook. So, Laura, we're speaking on Wednesday afternoon. The magazine has just gone to press, and our cover line is Drama Students, Yasha Monk on How Universities Raised a Generation of Activists. Can you talk to our listeners a bit about this cover, how it came about?
Well, I'm sure listeners will have seen the protests taking place across American universities, but they've also now started to begin at British universities. They began at UCL. They started at Oxford, at Cambridge, Manchester. And Yasha Monk is writing a really interesting piece, I think, about how the universities themselves have almost created this generation who feel like it's their job to protest. He says that, I mean, he's talking about America here, but he says that there are universities in America that offer scholarships explicitly for activists, and they often admit students in recognition of their high school activism. So I think that sense that they don't really have much of a leg to stand on now when they try and police these protests is kind of what he's talking about.
Yes, well, Yasha talks about these protests as an American import. So we started by asking him what has been going on in the US.
Yes, so we've had substantial protests against Israel and against Israeli military action in the Gaza Strip, you know, since October. They started immediately after October 7th, and some of these organizations explicitly rejoiced in the Hamas terror attack on Israeli civilians that took place that day. And they, you know, grew in support as a concern over the civilian death toll in the Gaza Strip, understandably grew over the course of months. You know, the nature of these protests was always contested. There was a core of it for which it's easy to have some amount of sympathy and empathy, but the protests all along failed to distance themselves from its more extreme elements and often intoned, deliberately provocative slogans calling for violence, like globalize the intifada. This made life on American campuses uncomfortable. It, you know, certainly intimidated some students who were visibly Jewish or who dared to speak out in defense of Israel, but it seemed to be somewhat under control. What happened then was that Minush Shafik, who was the director of the LSE until recently, had arrived at Columbia University, last summer, who's a very thoughtful person and quite a savvy political operator, was called in front of Congress. She'd escaped being grilled by Congress because of scheduling reasons when the presidents of MIT and Harvard and UPenn were hauled in front of Congress last fall. And she was determined not to repeat their mistakes. She was determined to make sure that she would clearly condemn anti-Semitism and that she would actually communicate some of the core values of the university. In the process of that, she promised to enforce the rules of her university much more energetically, including the rules against illegal protests or protests that violate university rules, that destroy university property, and so on. And as she was speaking, students tried to challenge her authority by setting up this encampment on the campus at Columbia. And so to show that she was serious about what she told Congress, she called in the police. And that set off a real firestorm in which people saw that action as heavy-handed, as out of keeping with a precedent that Columbia and other universities had set over the course of the last years of never really responding to illegal protest activity by calling in the police. That made Columbia students erect a second encampment in the day following this incident, and then became the spark which led to copycat encampments in many other American universities and colleges that also spread across the Atlantic to the United Kingdom and other countries.
Mm. Well, the crux of your piece, which you touched on there, is that there's the universities themselves are at fault for not having a clear and consistent line when it comes to free speech. So on the one hand, they allow the chanting of very provocative slogans, such as the ones you just mentioned, such as Global Intifada. But then on the other hand, universities are often banning speakers on campus and so on. So as you see it, where is the line here when it comes to how to manage protests, and how should the universities protect their academic freedom in how they allow certain types of protests to go ahead?
Yeah, so in my mind, a coherent set of rules and norms around free speech has to emphasize two things. The first is a very far-going tolerance towards offensive points of view. Part of free speech is, and part of academic freedom, is that it shouldn't be the decision of administrators or the university president what you can say and what you can't say. The second part of it, however, is that every defender of free speech has always recognized that there are restrictions as to the time, manner, and place of expressions of free speech. Nobody ever thought that shouting down a speaker or stopping people from being able to access a lecture hall in order to hear this speaker, or occupying university buildings, or destroying university property, or excluding people from parts of campus based on their political views is an acceptable expression of free speech. And what universities in Britain, but particularly in America, have done over the last decades is to fail on both sides of this equation in a way that seems paradoxical. So on the one hand, they have started to really patrol speech in an extreme way. In the United States, for example, MIT has disinvited a speaker who is going to talk about climate change because of his views about affirmative action. You know, Harvard allowed one of its departments to hound out a longstanding lecturer because of her statement on national TV that she believes in the existence of biological sex. And there was many other incidents like that. At the same time, these universities have signaled that they are not going to discipline students, and they're certainly not going to call the police when they break the rules that we've always needed for free speech, when they erect encampments, as they did during Occupy Wall Street, when they occupy the office of a university president, as they have done at many universities over the course of the last decades for a variety of causes. And so this failure has now come home to roost. And it's given students, in a sense, on both sides of the issue, reason to feel unfairly singled out. Jewish students, understandably, after October 7th, said, if any tiny microaggression against another group results in an anonymous call to a biased response team that then investigates what has been said, how can you tolerate people calling for global intifada loudly and proudly on the middle of our campus? Why are we the only ones who have to endure that kind of treatment? And pro-Palestinian protesters in the last weeks have said, well, hang on a second, if you allowed Occupy Wall Street to do these encampments, and if you allowed other students to occupy the offices of university presidents, why now are you calling in the police? So I think this failure of universities to stand up for their principles in comparatively calmer times is now making them incapable of acting in a principled way and in a way that has legitimacy, you know, in the wake of a turmoil and the higher emotions since October 7th.
Isn't it perhaps even worse than just a failure to uphold the rules, though, Yasha? Is it not actually, in some cases, a case of universities playing up rule-breaking or encouraging rule-breaking, or at least encouraging the legacy of rule-breaking? You know, there's a sort of proactive nurturing of some of the tactics which do go beyond acceptable expressions of free speech, don't you think?
Yes, and you know, this is rooted in part in the absurd American admission system. You know, Britain still, by and large, admits students on the basis of academic merit, and so you know they have to write some kind of personal statement on the application form. You know, that is really much less important than the core of the academic record, at least as I understand it, or as it was the case when I was at university in Britain. You know, in the United States, universities see themselves as these weird social engineers who need to make sure the demographic mix of the incoming class is exactly the right one. But they also need to make sure that there's a second violinist for the university orchestra. And they also need to make sure that, you know, the lacrosse team has all of the players it needs. And it also wants to make sure that there's a certain nice cohort of radical activists on campus who are standing up for that kind of tradition. And so you do, in fact, see at many universities a kind of nostalgic pride about the protests in the 1960s that they boast about on their websites. You see them, in the case of New York University, for example, publish this three-page website telling people what a wonderful place the university is to learn how to be a progressive activist. And it explicitly says a progressive activist, so it is politically coded quite openly. There are very expensive camps that rich Americans can send their kids to where they learn how to do political activism. And those camps explicitly carry the testimony of students who say this is what helped them get into college. There's scholarships for people who are, activists. And so, universities have encouraged activism, which is fine in itself, of course. Universities should be spaces where people are allowed to engage in political activism, but it's absolutely part of academic freedom and the general norms of a liberal society. But they have sort of courted and rewarded them. They said, we're going to admit you because you are activists. We're expecting you to be activists. And so universities shouldn't be surprised that those activists then see part of a role as challenging the university's authority. And indeed, that they expect to be mollycoddled even as they challenge the university's authority. So one of the stories that was most entertaining in the last weeks were the students at Columbia who occupied a university building in quite a brutal way, actually. They smashed in a window and the janitor is
taken
now
hostage,
on record as saying that he was essentially held hostage and is deeply traumatized by this experience. But the spokesperson for these protesters when Gil held a press conference where she said, we expect the university to cater us with food, which he called basic humanitarian aid. So that tells you something about this weird attitude where we're rebelling against the authorities, but we also kind of expect the authorities to be on our side. That is a delusion, but it's a delusion that the universities have in many ways courted and created.
The use of language like that when talking about protest, basic humanitarian aid, to talk about essentially just getting, Uber to deliver a pizza or something like that. There's a type of performance element to all this, don't you think? And you mentioned before the way that nostalgically we look back on the protests of the 1960s against the war in Vietnam, for example. I wondered what you think's going on there in terms of that idea of performance. And do you think it's actually unfair to compare the protests that are going on in campuses today to the 1960s protests against Vietnam? I mean, how are those protests different fundamentally?
There's parallels, but there's also important differences. One of the parallels is that in the nicest description of what those protests were about, they have a lot to recommend themselves. But the way in which they actually were formulated were often rather more troubling. There's many ways in which the protests of the 1960s did make the world a better place. But when you go back to what students were asking for at the time, they were casting in the lot with Fidel Castro and Cuba and the Cultural Revolution in China. I know students at the high school that I was at in Germany, well before my time, of course, marched down the main street of Munich shouting, Ho Chi Minh, Che Guevara, Lenin. So there's plenty of bad causes at the time. But part of what they wanted had personal stakes. They wanted to have more freedoms in how to lead their life on campus, including both being able to speak freely and in terms of being able, for example, to have romantic and sexual relationships. And especially for students in the United States, they had skin in the game because they feared being conscripted to fight in America's disastrous war in Vietnam. And so that's part of what gave those protests its staying power. What's strange now is not that there's some disturbing and disgusting slogans that protesters intone. We've seen that before. It is that they expect to have the authorities on their side in a certain sense, and to some extent do, because the authorities in the 1960s saw themselves as those tasked with upholding tradition and public order, and many of the authorities now see themselves as the natural inheritors of the 1960s. It's also that they have less personal skin in the game. I in many ways have the most empathy and sympathy for students who have genuine roots in the Middle East, students who perhaps are Arab, perhaps are Palestinian, or perhaps simply of Muslim faith, and who feel a personal connection to what's going on in Gaza. Many of the students who are spouting the most irresponsible slogans, who are explicitly expressing their solidarity with Hamas, who are fantasizing about global intifada, do not have those personal links. They're middle class, often white students who are play-acting revolution. And one of the striking things expressed in this demand for basic humanitarian aid and a few other expressions we've seen in the last weeks is that we're not just choosing to identify with people who are suffering in this conflict, which may be a laudable thing. They are cosplaying as, they are pretending to be those people. So the strange thing about this is when you're not saying, we're going to take certain political risks, we're going to face arrest in order to fight in solidarity with people who are suffering in Palestine, they want to cast themselves in the role of the Palestinians by saying, we occupying these buildings, you know, have lack of access to humanitarian aid, as somebody in Rafah or in another part of the Gaza Strip may be having lack of access to humanitarian aid. And that's, I think, a rather stranger and more disturbing form of play acting.
Will, did you have a protest at university?
No, I didn't. My memories of university seem so different to what it sounds like it is now. I mean, I did go to St Andrews in Scotland, which is known by students as the bubble because it's so isolated and far away from the rest of the world. So maybe it was just where I was rather than the time I went to university, if that makes sense. But I honestly remember almost no political controversy at all. There was a time a student managed to annoy a few animal rights types because he got drunk and ripped the head off a pigeon, and there was an attempt to try and get him expelled from the university. And honestly, I think that was as far as protest went in my time at St Andrews. How about you, friend of the picket line?
No, I never protested. Although I mean, it probably was the same time as you, Will, but it was obviously when all the tuition fees protests were going on. I do remember slightly thinking that £3,000, which was what it was when I was at university, actually felt quite reasonable and almost cheap for what, you know, what we were getting. So I remember thinking that perhaps the fees probably should go up a bit. So I didn't
a controversial those position to take when you're at
so that's why I didn't join those protests. Yeah. But I do remember those. I did feel like a slightly different time. I think perhaps people were perhaps less, I think maybe the internet changed it and social media changed it a lot.
I think so. Well, also on the subject of student protests, we have a piece in the magazine this week from The Spectator's Angus Colwell, who we sent along to the front lines of these university protests at Oxford, Cambridge and at UCL, his old university. As part of the research for his piece, he sat down with Anwar, a spokesperson for the protesters at University College London. He sent us that conversation, which we can hear an extract from now.
So hi Anwar, you set up the encampment now, you and other people, just around a week ago, is that right?
Yeah, so we're on day 7 now.
Okay, yeah. Wow. So what brought you here? What brings you here?
The students have come out to demand from the university that they divest from any companies which are complicit in the ongoing genocide in Gaza. And obviously, as if the situation was not already pressing enough, we've seen that, you know, offensive has begun now in Rafah boarding. 2.2 million people are essentially trapped, awaiting what seems like imminent death. And for the university to be dealing financially with any business which has a role in that, we all find that to be completely unacceptable. So we're demanding of the university three things: for them to divest fully from any companies complicit in ongoing genocide, for them to condemn Israeli war crimes, and for them to pledge towards the reconstruction of Gaza's education sector, which has been decimated as a result of those war crimes.
How has the university authorities, have they spoken to you guys so far?
So, unfortunately, they've not spoken to us directly, nor have they really addressed our demands either. There's been acknowledgement of our presence, but we're not here just for the sake of acknowledgement. We're here to get the demands met. And so we do intend to keep this up for as long as is deemed necessary, and don't intend to budge until the university meets those demands.
Okay, so I've been to some other encampments around the country in the last few days.
Right.
They've said that they will continue some form of action until the university meets their demands. Are you guys planning to maintain the encampment until the university meets your demands, or do you think you'll be pursuing other forms of action maybe over time?
Well, over time, we do intend that, of course, some further forms of protest might be too tame of a word, but further forms of making our demands apparent will be needed, and we are working towards those. At the minute, we are still trying to maximise turnout in the encampments, because this will help any further actions, because it will have bolstered numbers, right? So that being said, the be all and end all of what we're trying to do isn't just to camp out, because that isn't an action really in and of itself. So yes, essentially we do intend to bring this further.
Okay, do you think those different forms of action will be more disruptive, maybe?
Ideally, that's the point, because if it's not disruptive, it doesn't force the university to change their stance. The statement that was released by the provost indicated that what we have going on at the minute doesn't threaten or make them feel urgency. So as much as people are sacrificing, that is absolutely true, it's not enough. And so this is not the be-all and end-all of what we intend to do, and we do intend to escalate this further.
Okay. Have you had more and more people coming each day and joining the encampments, or...?
Yeah, so the growth has been steady. We have seen, when we first started, there was only a small patch of the grass which was occupied by the tents. But now we can see that the whole of one side of the main quad is filled with people who are united with us in the disavowal of the university's conduct financially otherwise. And we do expect these to keep on growing over the next coming days. And yeah.
Okay. Do you have exams at the moment?
My exams are done, but uh-huh. Many people they are in between exams and the encampment, that many people are, you know, here just revising their tents. People are making palpable sacrifices, but any of the sacrifices that we could potentially be making pale in comparison to what people living in the Gaza Strip sacrifice just by them living full stop.
Okay.
And so it's incumbent on us to, as people in positions of privilege of studying institutions in the West, we must forego something in order to achieve that larger, very crucial goal.
Okay. Some Jewish students at UCL said to me that they'd found parts of the encampment's presence hostile, in particular some of the people that were joining protests from outside the gates and around the gates. What would you say about that?
Well, none of the actions that have been done in this encampment or in any of the demonstrations have been remotely hostile full stop, let alone hostile to any particular minority group. We've always made it clear, this global student campaign, and we do see it as a global student campaign, is one which is championed by people of all walks of life. And so we say that Jewish students need not feel threatened in any way. The only thing that we are directing our hate towards the disregard for human life, particularly the disregard for Palestinian suffering, which is being done at the hands of the Israeli government. And we want to demand of the university to end their role in this. It's as simple as that. It's as simple as those three demands that I mentioned before: divestment, condemnation, and pledge towards reconstruction.
Uh-huh. Final question. Have food supplies remained steady? I remember when I was here on Sunday, there was a lot, and you guys had to give some back to food banks.
Yeah.
What sort of people have been bringing food? Have professors chipped in? Or?
Yeah, so it's really just been people from the wider community who have seen what we've got going on here, and they want to help in some capacity. And so they've really, really helped. We're not worried about supplies, thanks to the support of the community. Faculty have given us contributions as well. And so it really just shows how universal what we're demanding is, which kind of goes back to your other question about, you know, certain groups feeling ostracized. This is something which it's just a question of morality. It's not a question of ostracizing anybody.
And how have UCL security been?
Yeah, so security has tightened since we've begun, but it's the staff themselves have been very decent, and they've been as shown that they're not against what we're doing. And I, again, that kind of just tells us like how basic and clear what we're demanding is.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We want justice.
We want divestment.
Laura, what did you enjoy from the magazine this week?
Well, I'd like to flag two pieces actually by Philip Hensher. The first is a book review he's done about the Penguin Book of Bengali Short Stories. He says that whilst there are lots of writers who are Indian but who write in English that we're aware of, often people actually aren't necessarily so aware of writers in the Indian languages. So I think that review sounded really interesting. And then Philip's also done the Life column this week, and he talks about how he keeps getting these bright-faced activists coming to his door trying to convince him to vote for them. But he says the one thing that would make him vote for them is if they said that they were going to ban fun runs, because he's very opposed to fun runs.
Quite with him on that. Aren't you going on a fun run?
No, what I have done is I have done the park run a few times, but actually now I find it a bit annoying doing the park run because there are just so many people in the park. Mm. I prefer to go about an hour earlier. And actually here's an extract from Philip's column with him reading it.
"But," I said, "we're not very happy about the increase in the number of organised jogging events in Battersea Park. They take over the park at least twice a month." "What's wrong with that?" he said with a certain truculency. "It makes a lot of the park impossible to use," I said, "and it seems to require massive amounts of amplified encouragement. You know, go on, guys, you can do it. Reach for the stars. And amplified techno all over the park for hours. Dreadful." I thought I wouldn't say that the last time the dog walking friend and I came across one of these jogging bonanzas, we started shouting our own inspirational encouragements. "You go, guys, chafe those thighs. Every step, another brain cell gone. Pulverize that short-term memory. 1 hour closer to death. You go, guys." Greta, our schnauzer, who loves anyone new, had wandered into the hallway to see who I was talking to. The canvasser looked at me in a disapproving way. "Everyone thinks the fun run is great," he said. "I've never heard anyone complain about them." "Well," I said, "you asked me if I had any concerns, and you're hearing a concern now." "I don't think many people would agree with you," he said. "Not for the first time." I reflected that a surprising proportion of the human race think most people think is an argument at all likely to, on its own, to change someone's mind about anything. I mean, most people think George Eliot was a man.
Will, what about you? Anything you found?
I really enjoyed James Dellingpole's television review this week, in which he reviews Shard Lake on Disney Plus, because I'm a big, big fan of the series, the book series by C.J. Sampson, who, of course, died last week. And this is the adaptation of his first book in the series, Disillusion. And James has, and it's a sort of okay show, I think, but James has done so well to pick up on the things that do really annoy you as a viewer and as a fan of the books, because C.J. Sampson was had a brilliant attention to historical detail. He wouldn't fall into anachronism. And then the TV show, there's lines like "all women, I must deal with it," says a female character at one point, which just feels like a very kind of modern interjection into this setting. And James has done brilliant to pick up on a few of those, you know, things like "closed for repair" is something character says at one point as well, which doesn't feel particularly Tudor.
There's also a brilliant arts lead this week. Julian Spalding writes in defence of Beryl Cook, the artist. He says that she deserves to be taken much more seriously and is in the same kind of vein as Stanley Spencer and Hogarth. Sort of, reading the piece, it did actually make me reassess Beryl Cook's art and actually kind of think maybe Julian has a very good point here. So to discuss, we were joined by Julian and Rachel Campbell-Johnston, former chief art critic for The Times.
Julian, In the magazine this week, you write an excellent Arts Lead piece about Beryl Cook and how you believe she deserves to be taken more seriously. But to start with, just for listeners who might not be too familiar with her art, how would you describe it? How would you describe the progress of her career?
Well, Beryl was an exuberant observer of contemporary life in the pub and in the street. And she developed out of nowhere an extraordinary ability to paint very vivid images of groups of people, and all of them are enjoying themselves. Her art is a celebration of life and very funny. And it's lasting. I mean, I think nobody else painted hen parties, and she did it just brilliantly. And people will go on looking at her work, I think, because not only is it real and about a period of time, it's also beautifully designed and orchestrated. And it's real art. And I'm so glad they're putting on the show, because it's great to see her work again.
Mm. And Rachel, Beryl, as Julian points out in the piece, taught herself, and her art only became more popular over time. And in many respects, she should have been a darling of the art world. But as Julian says in the piece, the art establishment never really warmed to her. Why do you think that is?
Well, the thing about Beryl Cook is she isn't a painter who does great swashy brush strokes. She's not about the inner soul of her expression, which was very fashionable at the time she was coming out. I mean, she was beginning to paint when abstract expressionism was fashionable, and you could hardly get more different. And also her works are quite formulaic, I suppose. I think she used to say that she took a fortnight to do them, a week to plan them out, a week to colour them in. And she used to actually say colour them in, which isn't a particularly artistic term to use. And it's now probably the art world does look at it again, because they would talk about it as naive art, perhaps, untutored art. And she was untutored. She was a seaside landlady who found she had this extraordinary talent and used to paint in the cold winter months when she didn't have too many guests, and then gradually found that her painting took over from her guests because it became more and more popular. But sometimes being too popular without the help of the art world can get you there. I think sometimes it puts the art world out of joint. It puts their nose out of joint. They want to be the ones who spotted you and brought you on. And I think there might be an element of that in it. Mm.
Julian, on that point about the art world's reaction to her, you have a fantastic anecdote in your piece about the then Tate boss, Sir Nicholas Sirota, that I think is quite illuminating about how the art world viewed Beryl Cook. I wondered if you could share that anecdote with our listeners.
Yes, we were both invited to talk at a big conference in the Louvre in Paris. Nick was just starting work on the Tate Modern. He just got the lottery just come on stream, which made it possible. And it had been in people's minds for years. But anyway, suddenly there was a lot of money available. I was very nearly finishing a little gallery of modern art I opened in Glasgow. And we were both invited to talk. And I was talking about what was going in it and also what the philosophy of my gallery was, in that I don't like the word museum. It's termed in modern art. It's a contradiction in terms. And nothing can be immediately museum. It takes a while for people to appreciate what is the lasting art of their times. And curators can begin that process and select things that they think of real quality. So I spoke about what was going in, you know, David Hockney, Jean Tingley, and people like Beryl Cook. And there was a lot of laughter and enjoyment. And immediately I'd stopped speaking. Nick arose. He'd stopped speaking. He spoke before me. Nick arose from his line, and he was down in the front row. He rose, turned his ramrod back to me and addressed the hundreds of our curators from around the world in the audience, said, "There will be no Beryl Cooks in Tate Modern." And he sat down absolutely to silence. And I was, of course, a bit upset by this, because it was a fantastically sort of rude, sort of personal put down, professionally put down of me. But also it was terribly arrogant, because Beryl was just beginning really to work on a full steam ahead. And how could he know that she wasn't going to produce something that was really wonderful? And you just can't have that arrogance. You can't take that position. A curator can't take that position about art. They always have to step back and see what the artist is creating, not try to determine what art will be.
Well, there's also an irony, isn't there? Because quite a bit later, two of her paintings have been exhibited at Tate, albeit at Tate Britain. So, you know, history in a sense has borne out the talent of Beryl Cook in that regard.
Yes, but they've not bought it, and they've also not shown it, shown her work in a contemporary context, which the Studio Voltaire are doing now. And but she needs to be shown on side of Botero and of Edward Burrough and of Spencer and the 20th century artists. You know, she's one of them, and she was a real visionary. She's not a great artist, but she's a real one.
Rachel, what do you make of Beryl Cook's work now being on show at Studio Voltaire? And it's shown, I should say, alongside the work of Tom of Finland, who's an erotic artist. I mean, do you think A, there's a kind of new audience and a new interest in Beryl Cook? And also, what do you make of that duo, Beryl Cook and Tom of Finland?
Well, I mean, if you look very basically, you could sort of divide the function of art into two sort of areas. One is this expressive area, talking about an idea, an inner life, you know, a development of painting, a sort of part of the history of art and development. But the other thing is to record an era. And there is no one who records an era and that particular sector of society in which she works, perhaps with more clarity than Beryl Cook. I mean, who else is going to remember the blue eyeshadow, the white stilettos, the flared slacks, you know, the vinyl floors, the formica, the cooked English breakfasts, you name it. She has captured a sector of English society absolutely with immaculate detail. But the other thing I think is very interesting to compare her to is someone like Frida Kahlo. Frida Kahlo is now one of our most feted and expensive artists, not ours, but, you know, one of the most feted and expensive artists. And she paints in very much the same sort of way as Beryl Cook, technically speaking. She started in one corner of her canvas and coloured it in very slowly to the other end. There's none of that great virtuoso brushmanship, if you like, that people look for.
So in terms of, you know, how Beryl Cook isn't spoken of in the same breath as an artist like Frida Kahlo, is it the lack of a political edge to someone like Beryl Cook? Is it her sort of unassuming character? Has that played against her over the course of her life, do you think?
Yeah, I asked her once if she ever wanted to do a serious painting. And she said, if I thought it would change anything, I might. But I don't, so I don't. And actually, she says she'd sort of, she find the horrific sides of life really numbing. And she said, the thing that really interests me is things that make me enjoy life. That's what I'm trying to celebrate. That's what I think is my positive contribution. So she is in a way serious, and she also didn't take fools lightly at all. So there's a serious side of her humour, but it is humour and it is love and it is exuberance. And I think she is very like Frida Kahlo in a way, a lot of similarity. And though Rachel said she sort of colours in, she did in a way, but the drawing was really important to her. But so too was the painting and the colours. The colours are so vibrant. And she sees things so clearly that they sing. They sing, these paintings. And that's what makes them lasting.
And that's everything this week. As ever, please keep sending in all your feedback. We've been enjoying reading it all. Please email podcast@spectator.co.uk with your thoughts. And as ever, if you've enjoyed the podcast, if you pick up this week's magazine, you'll be able to read everything in full. I'm Lara Prendergast.
And I'm William Moore. And we hope you'll join us again next week.